Like a lot of you, in the week since two bombs exploded at the finish line of the Boston Marathon, I've watched a lot of coverage on TV, read everything from firsthand accounts to op-eds, and talked with countless people about their experiences. And I've noticed, as people have sought to describe and explain what they saw and felt during that anxious week, there's one word that I keep hearing again and again.
Surreal.
Just absolutely surreal.
It's really kind of surreal.
It's almost a surreal feeling.
A bit surreal.
If that word, surreal, was at the tip of your tongue too, you weren't alone. Peter Sokolowski is the editor-at-large for dictionary giant Merriam-Webster. He tracks the words people look up online in real time. The data is often something of a bellwether, providing insight into the mood of the country. On marathon night, that mood was clear.
At 8 o'clock that evening, we saw tragedy first, then shrapnel, terrorism, casualty, victim, atrocity, terror, and surreal. So we found that the words that were looked up in the immediate aftermath, such as casualty and shrapnel, were later joined by the word surreal as people started to sort of process this event.
The processing was interrupted on Friday when events took a series of unimaginable, violent turns. A police officer assassinated, a car chase along the Charles, a pre-dawn firefight in usually tranquil Watertown, and a manhunt that turned one of the country's busiest metropolitan areas into a ghost town. Sokolowski watched as the word surreal once again spiked through the day.
By the 19th, we saw the words terrorism and Chechnya being the top lookups in the news-related words, and surreal was number three.
And it also mirrors what's happening in our brains on a level deeper than language. Richard McNally is a professor in the Department of Psychology at Harvard.
I think that reaction arises from this sort of juxtaposition of something that's novel and very emotionally evocative against a context of familiarity.
Familiar. Boylston Street. A crime scene. Novel. Entire blocks of Boylston cordoned off, damaged, frozen in time, being combed over by authorities in white hazmat suits and blue rubber gloves. The key here, that thing that is triggering in our brains the sense of the surreal, is the novelty. All of the elements in the scene are familiar to us. We've just never experienced them together. So why is it that we're seemingly hardwired to respond so viscerally to a novel experience? McNally offers an explanation.
Novel stimuli are likely to be important ones and, of course, potentially dangerous ones as well. And certainly attending to these things, having all of your attention captured by it, having an emotional response that sort of mobilizes your whole mind and body, so to speak, makes sense because many novel things, of course, will be dangerous.
Like explosions at a marathon, a gunfight in a peaceful suburb, and an entire city on lockdown. And McNally says that the fear that accompanies dangerous situations can also contribute to that sense of being in a dream.
Many times when a person experiences an unexpected, terrifying, life-threatening event, they may feel as if it were not real. They may feel sometimes even disconnected from their body, feeling depersonalization, feeling derealization, as if it were in a dream.
From his standpoint, it makes all the sense in the world that people were using that word, surreal, to describe their experience.
So I think these are the sort of psychological variables that are playing a role. How precisely these are instantiated in networks in the brain is another matter. I'm sure the amygdala is involved.
The amygdala? Here comes a deep explanation.
The amygdala is a round ball of nerve cells, and it's connected to a circuit in the brain, and we think that it generates the emotional responses that people will get in response to some event which startles them or upsets them.
That's Dr. Matthew Fink, chief of neurology at New York Presbyterian Hospital. Networks of the brain are his stock and trade. He says that from a neurophysiological perspective, the brain makes no distinction between the real and the surreal, or even the unreal.
If your brain perceives something that it thinks is a life-threatening danger, whether that's real or not, it will react in the same way. Perception and reality then become the same as far as your brain is concerned.
In this case, there was a life-threatening danger, one that Fink describes as frighteningly real. And it's something that sets off a dramatic chemical reaction in the brain.
the sympathetic nervous system becomes activated and it releases hormones. And those hormones are cortisone, epinephrine, and norepinephrine, what we know as adrenaline. And the result of that is your heart begins to race, your rate of breathing goes up, you break out into a sweat, you might start shaking all over, and so that's really what happens, and it happens instantaneously.
And can last anywhere from a few minutes to more than an hour. For most of us, that intense chemical experience will have no real lasting effect. But for the families of those who lost their lives, the victims who were injured, and those who witnessed violent events that week, it will be a more lasting memory.
There's a big difference between being present when the event actually occurs and you're there live as opposed to seeing it on television.
Fink says that some could experience post-traumatic stress disorder, where the brain pathologically relives that moment of fear and initiates that intense chemical chain reaction again and again. In the end, if there is some note of hope for those victims, we find it in that same novelty that helped induce the seemingly universal sense of the surreal. Yes, the events on Monday, April 15th were violent. They were destructive. They were terrifying and warlike. But they were isolated. They were incongruous. They were out of the ordinary. And in the moments after the bombs exploded, and in the weeks since, you haven't had to look far to find so many people taking actions, large and small, that remind us the tragedy was just that, an isolated, out-of-the-ordinary event. Fink says that's an environment that bodes well for healing.
As opposed to, for example, soldiers who were fighting in a war in a hostile population. The people that were injured up in Boston were surrounded and supported by good friends and family members, and just the general population was extremely supportive. And that is a good result for them. So I think that's the only good part of the story.
A part that is, thankfully, just as real as the tragic events that started it all. Edgar B. Herwick III, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.